May it please the court. St. Louis County is here appealing from a judgment entered following a jury trial of condemnation exceptions. The county had acquired a 15-acre piece of property in connection with the Page Olive Connector project, and the property in question here today was undeveloped. It had been unoccupied and vacant for over 40 years, but because ownership was concentrated in one family that had owned it for 50-plus years, it was subject to this assessment of a heritage value, so an additional 50% beyond what the jury awarded. And the court, of course, has jurisdiction because the county has challenged the constitutionality of the heritage statute, but we are also here asking the court to reverse and remand this case for trial due to extensive trial error. And I would like to begin, subject to the court's questions, of course, just looking at some of that trial error. The most obvious and most discreet, clearly preserved issue of error was the fact that St. Louis County was not allowed to question the owner who testified about his previous opinion of value, which had been publicly stated during the commissioner's hearing. We tried to get that into evidence to show that the owner had previously stated his opinion of value was $400,000+.
Why wasn't that something for the trial court? You argued that that was his opinion of value, and the other side said, no, that was a statement and settlement negotiations, and he thought that's what he was supposed to be answering to the question. And the trial court listened to that and resolved it as something he thought was part of settlement negotiations.
Was what? I'm sorry.
So part of the settlement negotiations, and therefore not something that could come in. I understand you think that was right. Should have come to the other conclusion, but why wasn't that something on which we defer to the trial court?
I have two answers or two responses to that. First, I believe you're mischaracterizing the trial court's ruling. The trial court didn't say that it was in settlement negotiations. He just said, I don't know if this guy really believed that was the fair market value or if he based that on an appraisal or he based
that. It was the exact number that was talked about in settlement negotiations.
Yes, it was, but I don't see how that would be relevant. The source of his opinion of value, whether it came from that or from a previous appraisal that he had acquired, doesn't change the fact that he stated, at a time when it was in his best interest to state the highest value of that property to the commissioners, he said, here's what it's worth. Secondly, however, we did have a very good offer of proof on that, and the witness to the statement was specifically asked, was he asked, what's your opinion of value? Yes. What was his answer? I think it was 496. So we have a very clear statement in the record that he had given an opinion of value. So to the extent one would question, well, was that really settlement or did he believe it was something else, that would go to weight, not to admissibility.
But you're saying the trial court erred as a matter of law in saying that he made that statement. That was the basis of the ruling, wasn't it?
I don't believe it was the basis.
What do you think the basis of the ruling
the
was?
The court said that she couldn't tell if that was, like, in his heart what he believed or if it came
and
from
and therefore she concluded what in keeping it out?
She said she wouldn't admit it because she didn't know if that was really his opinion. But the issue is, did he state an opinion of value? He stated that's his opinion of value. So what's in his heart or what the source of his belief of that is the opinion for value, I don't believe is relevant. And combined with the fact that we had just a specific offer saying he said this is the opinion of value, that should come in, both as impeachment to the very large figure that they offered into trial of $1.296 million, but it also should be independently admissible as an admission against interest by one of the parties to the case. And so by keeping that out, we had two appraisers who said in the $200,000, they had an appraiser that at this $1.296 million, it would have been helpful, and I think a reasonable person wanting to know about the value of the property would have wanted to hear what the opinion of value was by the owner, given at a time when it was in his best interest to state the highest possible opinion of value. So I think that very discreet, significant error, that alone should cause this court to remand it and let the county have a shot at getting all the evidence in for the jury's consideration. But another very important problem in this trial was the extensive testimony, which was not based on the value of the property by any means, but instead, this case rapidly devolved into statements and questions suggesting that the owners were forced to give this property up. They lost out on this property. The Novels began their opening statement by saying they didn't choose condemnation, and then we have inaudible, and it said they were forced to go out and put this property up for sale, inaudible. So this also ties into our belief that we need to remand to develop a better record. There was so much of the record was...
Were objections made here that were inaudible, or were these things where no objections were made?
I don't believe an objection was made there, but I think at some point we had a cumulative effect of it becoming plain error. And when objections were made, they were overruled, Judge.
Two statements referring to...
Yeah, statements what? That related not to value. For instance, in closing argument, counsel talked about, well, you had this going on, and then to add insult to injury, and counsel promptly objected and said, this is about fair market value, not insult or injury. Court overruled it. But more importantly even is that some of this that I think was plain error, very clearly was plain error, was not just plain error, but only could have been corrected by the court's intervention. And here's specifically what I'm thinking about was the repeated references to these people having a gun to their head. You know, that was the cross-examination, during cross-examination of the county's appraiser. Our appraiser testified about values and was asked, yeah, but that's someone who sold without a gun to their head.
But as I recall, objections were never made to this testimony.
There was not an objection to that, but I think it's plain error. Certainly an objection, I think, would have been ineffective in this case.
Do you have other cases where similar statements have been found to be plain error?
I had the reverse end of that. Was the case this court decided back in 2002. It was cited in the novel's Motion in Limine, and that was the city of Springfield, I think, versus Thompson. And it was the reverse in that was a case where the condemnor made a reference to the fact of whether this payment of the award would come out of the taxpayer's money, something like that. I mean, if you think about it, the condemnor errs and brings in non-market values when they start talking about, hey, it's a great value, or you don't want the taxpayers to have to pay more. This is the other end of that when the people being condemned bring in, oh, my gosh, we love this property. We never would have sold. We had a gun to our head.
And you're saying that was found to be plain error?
It was reversed. I don't remember if there was an objection, but it was not sustained, or the court...
The reason I say it's very rare to find plain error, even in criminal cases, much less civil cases.
I understand that, but it's limited, as this court said in another condemnation case, I think that was an appellate case, Heights. It's limited when the admission of evidence engenders hatred, passion, or prejudice.
Yeah, and generally requires miscarriage of justice, and generally we think lawyers will object if they're in the heat of battle and they think there's going to be a miscarriage of justice.
I understand, and there was no error in that particular statement. On the other hand, I don't think that makes it less plain error. Sometimes you might lose something in the course of a trial, and this is a subtle but so powerful statement that I don't think it can be corrected except by the court.
I know you don't think their expert was credible, but the verdict was within $3,000 of what their expert said the property was valued. How is that evidence of passion or prejudice?
Well, the fact that it was at that high end, I do think it's evidence.
But is there any case that has found passion or prejudice where it's that close to the amount to which testimony was offered?
Well, again, looking at the city of Springfield case, the court reversed it because the statement was intended and had no other purpose than to engender passion or prejudice. And I think it's particularly a reason for this court to consider finding plain error, because one question I hope the court wants to consider is, what kind of behavior do we want to encourage from our attorneys? This isn't some new attorney who inadvertently made a little mistake. We had very capable, very competent trial counsel who knows better than this, who's tried 100, I'm guessing, condemnation cases, someone I would go to for help if I needed information about condemnation, and for an attorney to purposefully interject what is known to be absolutely impermissible and perhaps take advantage of, this was the court's first condemnation case, so I think it's understandable that the court might not have been attuned to.
I notice you only have 2.5 minutes left, and it was on direct appeal here because of the constitutional issue. I want to make sure you have a chance to address it.
Thank you, Judge. Time gets away from you.
It goes fast.
It does. On the constitutionality, I know the court has heard arguments on this before, and then the case settled, but... So I tried to listen to those arguments and see what the court's concerns were. I believe that the problem here is that the legislature does not have the ability and has invaded the province of this court when it changes the definition of just compensation. The Constitution says just compensation is required. It's up to the court, not to the legislature, to interpret the Constitution. And this court said in Union Quarry back in the 60s, just compensation is fair market value. Anything more than that, you have unjust enrichment. So just compensation doesn't just take into consideration the interests of the particular landowner, but of all the people in St. Louis County who are required to pay their verdict.
So why was that interpretation right? I know in your brief you say, well, we've defined it, and therefore we have to follow the definition of just compensation in our prior case. But our prior case didn't deal with the statute. It didn't consider the issue of heritage value or homestead value, and didn't consider it in that context. Why was that blanket statement correct?
Because the statute can't override the Constitution.
No, I know, but why does just compensation mean fair market value? If that's what it was meant, why didn't the Constitution use the term fair market value?
Well, it could just as easily have said fair market value as just compensation. I don't know why one term was used as opposed to another.
Well, that's what I'm asking you. But just compensation doesn't necessarily, I mean, it depends on the context of misused. It depends on why would they say just compensation and use the broader term if they meant to confine the court to one specific meaning, fair market value.
Well, I don't think the Constitution confined the court, but rather the court interpreted the Constitution. And that
Counsel, what is just, is there something that helps us understand, other than that case, what just compensation means, and what is the authority other than our prior case that says just compensation always means fair market value?
Well, I am relying on the court's past cases.
So why was that right? I want your help as to why that was correct and why it can't include something like heritage value when you're dealing with a home.
Well, first of all, that's a completely arbitrary category also. So I don't know how the court could sustain that.
Is it rational for the legislature to, is the use of this type of heritage value, is that a totally irrational thing for the legislature to have done?
I would say yes, it is. In particular, this case is actually a very good example of that, because you have a property that's undeveloped, abandoned. No one's touched this property in 40 years, and the fortuitous fact that they had not gotten around to selling it. You have absentee landowners. There's no arguable basis of benefit to the community just because the same family owned it. What would be the basis for requiring that? And in fact, it's contrary, this absentee owners, for them to get more, kind of goes against other statutory schemes. For instance, the statutes allow local jurisdictions to require registration of property and the charge of fee to absentee landowners, like the novels, because there's an assumption that kind of absentee ownership is a problem for the community, encourages decayed property and nuisance on the property. So I think that to assume or to suggest that you're entitled to more because you've owned it more, even though you're not a part of the community, and that's not a basis at all of the finding, I do think that's arbitrary.
Your opponent argues that you didn't raise these constitutional objections at the earliest opportunity, and you say, well, there was no pleading that we could have raised it in. Do you have an affirmative duty to do it in a separate pleading of your own?
I don't know why there would be a duty or what benefit that would have been to the court. When we initially file a case, of course, in our pleadings, we don't know whether property is heritage property or not. So the time it comes up, what we're objecting to is the addition of it onto the jury award, and as soon as the judge proposed adding that on, the county objected. It wouldn't be a pleading.
Well, what they say is that initially there was an addition of heritage value, and then you objected to that, and that's why it went to a jury trial. But, I mean, there was an objection to the amount given, and so by the commissioner. So, and at that point, heritage value was added in, and no objection was made. They're saying that's the point where you could have raised that issue at the
commissioner. You couldn't object. We're not challenging the addition of it.
I understand, but you could have raised the constitutional issue at that time and didn't. That may be inappropriate.
It would be utterly pointless, Judge, because that's an interim verdict or an interim order. It's not a judgment, which is never going to be subject to appeal. You really can't challenge the addition of the award at that point, because what happens is the court enters an order, says this is the amount you pay into court, and two things can happen. One, you either have a jury trial on the exceptions, as happened here, and then that goes away, and you're only worried about what the judgment is, or else the party settlement. settle it. If you're willing to settle, even based on this increased extra, there's no reason to change it.
So you offered to pay it, including heritage value, at that time. You could have objected at that time, but chose not to.
We were happy to pay the $400,000 as a settlement value, whether you call it, we don't care what you call it. That was an amount we were willing to pay to manage our risk, not to have to go to trial.
Well, I understand, but it just if you're saying you couldn't have raised it earlier, you certainly could have raised it then. You made a strategic decision, which may have been a good one not to, but...
I wouldn't really agree it's a strategic decision. I would say, what's the point of raising it then? That is going to go away. That order, that amount is going to go away because the court will either enter judgment and add heritage verdict to the heritage value to the jury verdict, or the parties settle it. It's a meaningless number. It's a meaningless thing. And to challenge it, again, it's never going to be subject to appeal or review by this court.
You have time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. The first thing I want to do is show you in 30 seconds what the case was about using an aerial. I think it would help the court understand. If you read the transcript, you'll hear something called Snoopy's head all the time. And Snoopy's head was half of the property. You see an outline in red in the middle. That right half is what we call Snoopy's head, and it was to be developed, was our contention. It's called Novel, that's the family. To the top is called Mill Ridge. That is a development that we said we could be that too. On the south was Terra Vista, another subdivision, and we said we could be that too. We were 15 acres, half of it was usable, and our story was very simple. The Levy District redid the floodplain floodway maps so that all of a sudden all this property that was partially in floodway could now be reclaimed as floodplain. The maps had changed. And so the next day, basically, Mill Ridge is developed, Terra Vista is developed, offers are knocking at our door, and we say no, for whatever reason. It's been in the family for over 100 years. Okay? So that was our story. The land had been reclaimed for floodplain. We could bring in fill to build on it. We could be something similar to Mill Ridge. We could be something similar to Terra Vista. In terms of value, the case was also very simple. A developer in Mill Ridge, the MR, sold to another developer for over $2 a square foot. Terra Vista was a guy, a school teacher, who lived in the house, lived on a larger piece of property, lived in the Terra Vista and land next to it in his house, and he sold it very cheap. We said the value could be established by the developer to developer sale. They said no, from the school teacher to the developer sale, which was much lower. And that became the case in essence. To address the first primary issue, that is a forced gun, you know, a forced sale, a gun to the head, Ms. Reddington is right. In cross-examination of their expert, I went through a litany. How do you get what's called a comparable sale, that is a sale of another piece of property to establish the value of the property being condemned? In a recession. And so the cross-examination is, you agree that to get a comparable sale, it's a willing buyer and willing seller. There's no gun being pointed at the head of the seller to sell. It's not a forced sale, like being moved to another town, a death in the family, something like that. Agree, 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 says the expert. The next question. Would you agree that in a recession, like we're having right now, a couple years ago, the only people who'd be putting property up for sale would typically be somebody under duress because they use sales of other property? Their expert says yes, and yet he uses them, which hurts his credibility. The other point that killed their credibility, before I go into the heritage value constitutionality, is this. In the Mill Ridge, which was our primary comparable sale, we said to the expert, well, you talked to the guy down below. Did you talk to the developer who sold the property? No. You didn't? I couldn't find him. Wait a minute, I said. Didn't you use two sales of the same developer? a few blocks away as comparable sales? Yeah. So you're able to talk to him about these other sales, but you forgot to ask him about this sale that we relied on. Yeah. It just didn't sell very well to the jury. And that is what happened. On the issue of constitutionality, heritage value, I want to talk about this. The issue is this. Is it right for the legislature? Is there a rational basis for the legislature to say, if the property's been in the family for more than 50 years, you will increase it by 50%? That's basically the heritage value statute. And the first thing I want to do say is this. I want to talk about waiver for 1 second. After the commissioner's hearing, which is when we came into the case, the first thing we did was we filed a motion for assessment of heritage value on the commissioner's award. We filed it. Under the law, case law, you have to object at the first opportunity, and we cited cases for that. You have to object at the first opportunity, and you have to be specific. So we go in, we file it, county is cooperating with us, there's no objection filed on record or on paper, and we get it. And now they want to come after the trial, a year and a half later, after the property owner, after the judge had already ruled on it, the property owner had relied upon the earlier judgment, and I call it, it's almost like an ambush after the fact. After the trial is over, they say, oh, wait a minute, we now think we have an objection. That would defeat the whole purpose of challenging a statute at the earliest opportunity to give the trial judge an opportunity to reflect and think about it and make the right ruling. Because if they had their way, and if the judge, after the trial, had ruled it's unconstitutional, now that trial judge has to undo awarding the heritage value after the commissioner's award. It just doesn't make sense, isn't the way we do trials in general. The other thing I want to say, can the state legislature across the street award something above fair market value? First of all, the second waiver, in their motion for new trial, they never gave that as a reason for appeal. What they did say in their motion for new trial was, under Article 126, it's the jury's job to assess the 50%, not the judge. That was their objection on the motion for new trial. Not, oh, it's above fair market value. But putting that issue aside, fair market value has been ruled in some cases by the Missouri Supreme Court. Traditionally, just compensation has been understood as fair market value. In another line of cases, it will say by the courts, just compensation is understood to be an indemnity purpose, trying to put the homeowner or whatever in the same position as if the condemnation had never occurred. There is nothing that prevents, as I said in the brief, that prevents the legislature from giving additional compensation. In most states, we do it in relocation very often. That is, if you move, pay these guys for moving costs. Or in court, we say prejudgment interest, which later became by statute. These are additional. About a third of the states give business damages by statute. And some cases I would like to cite that we didn't put in the brief, but I would like to say this. The state of Michigan defines just compensation to mean fair market value, and if it's a principal house being taken, 25% above the fair market value, Article 10, Section 2 of the Michigan Constitution, after the famous Kelo case, they added that.
But this wasn't added in the Constitution.
This was
statutory.
That is correct, which brings me to Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania has a statutory definition of just compensation to be fair market value plus, quote, such other damages as provided in the code. And that's been upheld in 641 A second 11 and 526 A second 843, where the statute defines it and they say, okay, there's another part of the code that dealt with relocation, this or that, and it comes in. There is no logical reason why, whether it's part of a definition of just compensation or it's just an add-on, as most states would do, either through relocation or a third of the states that will say, you know, in addition to fair market value, in addition to just compensation, as you would say, give them attorney's fees, give them business damages, whatever.
But that's provided in the Constitution to allow other compensations or allow regulations, or et cetera. But that's still provided in the Constitution.
What is in the Constitution is simply two words. You shall pay just compensation. Nowhere in the Constitution is it defined. The courts have left it to themselves to say, we say traditionally we use it to mean just compensation or indemnity. In no state in the country I have ever found, in my 30 years of doing just compensation, in no state in the country have I ever found a court that struck down additional compensation awarded by the state legislature. In this case, for heritage value.
Well, when they look at,
go ahead.
In addition to comparable sales and condemnation of business cases, are there other methods which are traditionally or often testified to concerning fair market value? I mean, in commercial cases, sometimes there's more than just comparable sales, correct?
In commercial, generally speaking, Judge, with the exception of Georgia, I'll say, most states say, as a matter of case law, unless the state legislature specifically gives business damages, they are not recoverable. In all states, including Missouri, if the situation warrants it, you can use business damages or business losses to measure the fair market value of the property, especially when the business is tied to the property, like a quarry.
Right, fair market value. Fair market value, not necessarily just comparable sales.
Comparable sales, the income approach, the cost approach, are simply tools that the experts use to arrive at fair market value. And as all cases will say, why do we talk in terms of fair market value? It's a kind of like an objective method to arrive at just compensation. But even, I cite in my brief, there are circumstances, even in Missouri, we do not rely upon fair market value to arrive at just compensation. A good example is when a government condemns a government facility like a school. Sometimes it happens. And then what happens is the Missouri courts have followed all the other states across the country. We call it this facilities doctrine. And what it does is you don't pay fair market value. You pay the replacement value under those circumstances. So that's a situation where we disregard. Another situation in the federal relocation law, which applies to all states that touch federal monies, which is just about everything, all road projects, there's a situation where if you condemn a slum house, you, as the condemning authority, have to pay whatever it takes above the fair market value of that slum house to get that person in decent and sanitary housing. Okay? We disregard fair market value. The question is, what kind of bill do we give the government? And the answer is, whatever it takes to put that family in safe and sanitary housing, even if their house is worth a lot less. So when you look at just compensation, maybe it makes sense that it's not defined in the Constitution. You know, it's a term we labor with, we work with. In the heritage value situation, where if you owed it 50 years, it's obvious that when the Missouri Task Force recommended it to the state legislature, it was a way to discourage the use of eminent domain. It's no secret that since the famous Kelo case started out several years ago out in Connecticut, where they wanted to expand for economic reasons, for Pfizer to expand, that eminent domain is something that people have try to take a hard look at and try to discourage its use. One way to discourage its use, which I did not put in the brief, which I should have, is you make it more expensive. And what the county wants to argue is that, wait a minute, we should only be required to pay the fair market value and nothing more.
Do we have to overrule our earlier case in order
No.
to? Why not?
Because the only earlier case that you would probably want to say is that there's a couple of cases where the court was defining just compensation as fair market value. And I think that the truth is, if you look over all the cases in Missouri, again, I say you'll find two strands. One is fair market value, one is indemnity. And I think that the truth is, Judge, is that when we talk of fair market value, that's a traditional concept. That even in Missouri, we haven't applied in all situations. Like I talked about the condemnation of public facilities. Mm-hmm. You know, we will change. We have another concept in condemnation called special use property, where we throw away the book on fair market value because we're trying to, in essence, trying to indemnify in that situation. This is not, quote, a strict indemnification issue. The issue is, are there some situations where the legislator speaks and says, we want to give additional compensation, whether it's because of the attachment to the land for more than 50 years, whether it's because we want to discourage eminent domain in these types of situations, whether it's because when you displace somebody from their own principal residence, that we want to recognize maybe some extra hardship.
What's the purpose of the requirement that the government pay just compensation to take property in the Constitution? Is it to protect citizens from the government, or is it to restrict how much the government can pay?
It's a good point. Eminent domain is deemed an inherent power of the sovereign state. And in colonial times, there was no such thing as just compensation. They were just grabbing property, no compensation being paid. The Constitution, the Fifth Amendment, came in to restrict the inherent power of eminent domain. You cannot go grab somebody's property unless you pay them just compensation, and it's for a public use.
And so if that's the intention, then is it the minimum that the government can pay?
Yes.
Just compensation,
as
opposed to the Constitution is intended to limit the government to pay no more than just compensation.
Right. There are a lot of cases that say you can't go below fair market value, but there's no restriction for the state legislature, and sometimes through case law, to add additional. And it kind of makes sense. We use relocation as a vehicle, we use statute above just compensation, and we use it by statutory definition of just compensation, like in Missouri or Pennsylvania.
But there's also a distinction between just and fairness. For example, in the Amerine case, the Supreme Court of the United States, there was a dissent in the Herrera case, which is about a similar kind of case, where Justice Thomas and Scalia said, even though it's a criminal case, you've gone through the whole procedure, justice has been done, the people have been convicted, let the governor do clemency, even though they may be actually innocent. In the Amerine case, Mr. Joseph Amerine, all the evidence was he wasn't guilty even after trial. So justice had been done in that the process had worked, or the process had been thoroughly vetted. However, he wasn't guilty. He was actually innocent. Right. So fairness would be you don't execute him. But justice might be you completed the process.
I like to think Heritage Valley was a combination of justice and fairness combined, which I'm over time, but I just want to leave you with one final slide, then I give you a U.S. Supreme Court case, 113 U.S. 9, 1885. 113 U.S. 9, 1885, 150% of the value of the property for building a mill, period. That's all the statute said, and they upheld it.
Counsel, I noticed that opposing counsel says the Supreme Court said in Bauman v. Ross that just compensation means a compensation that would be just in regard to the public as well as in regard to the individual.
I see that once in a blue moon, but 99% of the case law focuses on this. They always have the same phrase. It's not what the government lost or gained. It's what the property owner has lost. The focus of the Fifth Amendment is the just compensation is a restriction on the government to protect the property owner. So if you look at all the cases from the U.S. Supreme Court down to most of the states, the focus is what has the property owner lost, which is why we often talk in terms of indemnification when we come to just compensation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Could you submit the cases you haven't put in your brief by letter with a copy to your opponent?
Sure. Will do. Thank you.
Counsel, you're relying on the Quarry case, but in that case, the Supreme Court said the just compensation referred to, generally speaking, is the fair market value of the property at the time of the taking. So why doesn't that generally speaking allow for determination in some circumstances that something more is required for just compensation?
Well,
and here the legislature found it included heritage value.
Okay. The court went on, though, and also said anything more than that was unjust enrichment.
Anything more than just compensation.
And it's generally fair market value. The times when it isn't, the exception might be, I think Mr. Denlow pointed out, if you're acquiring facilities for which there is no fair market value. Obviously, if you can't find fair market value, you're going to have to find an alternative. But I don't see any way the court can rule in favor of this statute or uphold this statute without reversing its prior decision.
Well, why wouldn't it say that in the case of properties with heritage value, just compensate. I mean, why wouldn't they be free to hold or not to hold? That just compensation includes something more in the case of properties with heritage value. I'm unclear why. Why?
Because fair market value.
Because it said generally speaking, that indicates there may be exceptional situations where that's not the case. So why would that need to be overruled?
Because there's no exception here. There is a fair market value available for the court to find or the jury to find in this case. The other cases cited, there was no fair market value. But let me take that. I don't feel I can say any more to convince the court on that. I do think you would need to reverse your prior opinion. Of course, you could do that, or if you disagree, regardless, you still are left with the constitutional requirement that just compensation has to be determined by the jury. So for the legislature to say, well, this is just compensation, mm-hmm. and then allowed the court to add it on, that's strictly forbidden by the Constitution.
I mean, the calculation is based on the jury's finding, hasn't the jury actually set the number that has to be used to calculate what the heritage value is going to be?
No, because the jury has said, here's what we think compensates you for it. So if there's something additional, the jury should be advised of it. The jury setting just compensation has the right to make that final decision.
Well, and why aren't all the prejudgment statutes unconstitutional?
Because
the jury doesn't calculate the interest.
No, but because the constitutional requirement is you give them fair market value as of the date.
Well, there's a constitutional right to jury trial, which we've said includes damages. So if the jury has to determine the interest, if that's accurate.
I don't believe it is, because I don't think interest is part of the fair market value or the just compensation as of the date of taking. The court has to add it on, or I guess you could have the jury add it on, because if you don't add on prejudgment interest, you're taking away from the property owner what they were entitled to. They were entitled to $100,000 on the date of taking. If you don't give it to them for another year and a half, you haven't really given it to them. That
so
isn't an
add-on.
So doesn't the jury
have to determine that?
No.
Why
no.
not?
Because the jury decides what's just compensation on the date of taking, and that was done. That is done. To preserve that or to not further condemn mm-hmm. what the plaintiffs or the property owners.
I understand your argument.
Okay.
Thank you.
What about in the pleadings, back to this issue of whether or not you waive your constitutional claim, In the pleading structure of a condemnation case, once it's in front of the circuit court, couldn't you have amended a count for declaratory judgment concerning the heritage value statute? I mean, you could have done it any time, but certainly you could always raise that issue in pleadings of the case if you thought a statute was unconstitutional and wasn't an affirmative defense or something like that. You could just file a count seeking a declaratory judgment that it was unconstitutional.
I hadn't thought about that, but the fact that one can do it doesn't mean that one is required to preserve the objections. And I would say here, our only challenge is to the addition of the award, the addition of heritage value after the jury's award. And so I believe we raised that in a timely, at the first time it came up, which is when the plaintiffs asked that it be added on.
Well, did you try this case assuming there would be no heritage value? Is that what you're trying to say? I mean, you understood that the trial of this case would include some heritage value.
That they would ask for it, and at that time we would oppose it, which is the first time in the pleadings, I think, that it's appropriate.
Thank you. Any more questions? Of course, the case will take under submission.